Tonight on the Daily Debrief, a tearful sentencing for a babysitter convicted of murdering a girl by shaking her so violently that she never recovered. The girl's parents demand justice.
I cannot describe the pain that comes along with watching your child suffer, burying your child.
The defendant's friends ask otherwise.
Lindsay is innocent, and we will appeal.
Plus, a family of four killed with a hammer, their bodies buried in the desert. This man is on trial, and the attorneys are fighting.
All three of them go round and round and round, saying things that are not true.
Are trial delays due to a serious health issue or something else?
I happened to be at a social event with Mr. McGee on Saturday, where he was perfectly fine drinking and dancing.
Also, the cop whose cruiser a defendant stole to wreak more havoc on a crash that already left five teens dead. This is the Daily Debrief. It's Thursday, May 9th. And good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Debrief. Attorney Joseph Tully will be with us in just a moment. We begin tonight with sentencing for an Ohio babysitter accused of murdering the little girl who was in her care. Lindsay Parton stood before a judge after jurors agreed she killed 3-year-old Hannah Weshey. Prosecutors said Parton shook the girl and caused her death because Parton was angry about how much she was being paid and because the girl dumped a bottle of ketchup down the toilet. Hannah's mother and father both spoke today.
My daughter Hannah, I have no doubt, would have accomplished a lot in her lifetime. And I used to dream of the days where I would experience milestones with her. I no longer dream of those days because they are just that, dreams that will never come to fruition, forever non-existent. And accepting my powerlessness over all of this has been the hardest thing to come to terms with. Hannah deserves nothing less than justice. And I hope that when she and I are reunited in the kingdom of heaven, I can kneel before her, wrap my arms around her, look into those beautiful big brown eyes. And have her take comfort in these words. Mommy's home and I will never leave you again, baby girl.
I can't even begin to describe the anger that I feel. Obviously, I'm hoping you give her the maximum punishment you can give her. I hope she never gets out of jail for what you did to my daughter. It's unthinkable. I don't even know how to begin to describe it. I hope and pray every single day that you get the same treatment in jail that you showed my daughter. That's what I hope for. I hope you sentenced to the max.
Back during the trial, the defense claimed that father you just heard should have been investigated as a suspect. Parton's friends stood up for her and said her family needs her around.
Lindsay is innocent, and we will appeal. Judge, I ask you to think of Vivian and Savannah and TJ. They need their mother at home. TJ needs his wife at home. We need her with us. Please do not throw Lindsay's life away. She is valuable. She is worth something. Do not ruin these little girls' lives.
The judge sentenced Parton to life in prison with the chance of parole after 15 years on the murder charge, plus an additional 3 years for child endangerment. Now to the case of horror on the highway. A Vermont man accused of speeding the wrong way down an interstate and slamming into a car carrying 5 high school students. Stephen Burgoyne is on trial facing 5 counts of second-degree murder, 1 count of aggravated operation, and 1 count of gross negligence. The victims of that massive fiery crash were all 16 and 15 years old. None of them survived. And here's where it gets even more shocking. After the first crash, Burgoyne stole a responding police SUV, took off, turned around, and then caused a second crash. Here's some of the dash cam footage.
Now we got a person trapped in the car. It's full of fire extinguishers. Who stole my car?
The officer whose vehicle was stolen was on the witness stand today. He picks up the story when he saw his own police SUV barreling back towards him.
I could hear it before I could see it. It was definitely engine to the max.
Okay. And what did you first see?
I saw that bright white light that was on the front of my vehicle.
Okay. So you knew that it was your vehicle coming back?
Without a shadow of a doubt.
You said you drew your firearm. Did you draw your firearm because you were considering firing at your cruiser?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. And what decision did you ultimately make about firing at it?
I had just enough time to think that through, and vehicle that was going 100 miles an hour, shooting from an angle, plus I saw some folks in the background. It wasn't worth the possibility of that. And then an uncontrolled vehicle at 100 miles an hour with an incapacitated driver probably would not have been the wisest.
The cruiser, was it swerving or was it following a direct path?
A direct path.
Okay. And what did the cruiser do?
The cruiser struck the truck that was initially involved in the first collision that was in the middle of the passing lane.
Okay. And at some point, did you observe the operator of your cruiser vehicle?
Yes, it was a rather eerie experience. As the two vehicles collided, time slowed to almost nothing, and I was able to kind of track the vehicle as it moved forward, and actually watch the operator get ejected out the driver's side window. It was something that will stick with me. That was a very, very bizarre thing to watch.
Yeah. And you had never seen something like that before?
Absolutely not. I hope never again to see that.
The big question in this case is whether Burgoyne was legally insane. There's evidence stacking up on both sides of that argument.
This trial is about why it happened.
During opening statements, Stephen Burgoyne's defense said Burgoyne had a history of mental health treatment, which points to insanity.
The evidence will be that Stephen Burgoyne was totally psychotic and delusional at the time of the crash.
But one witness for the state said Burgoyne talked to him after the first crash.
He just says, I don't know what happened, I just lost control, in kind of that cadence.
Burgoyne did not speak to the police after the second crash.
I asked him if he was involved in the crash.
Did he respond to you?
No.
The defense says he doesn't remember any of it.
Days later, he's confused, paranoid, he doesn't know why there's guards in the room.
But one responding officer and a nurse both said Burgoyne tried to flee as he was being treated for severe injuries.
The doctor asked if I could take the handcuffs off because he said it was making it hard for him to breathe.
How did Mr. Burgoyne respond to having his handcuffs taken off?
He attempted to get up.
When they took the handcuffs off, he went to get off from the ground and take off again. He tried to get away.
He did a quick spin, and I think he got up to maybe his knee, but then I was able to get him back onto the ground and put him back in handcuffs again.
I said, I am not going to be helping with this because I didn't know what he was capable of doing.
The statement and the flight attempt could be the state's best evidence that Burgoyne lacked the adequate capacity to appreciate that his conduct was criminal. That is half of Vermont's insanity defense. But the jury could still find him insane by determining that he could not conform his conduct to the law. And ultimately, that's the big question. Joining me tonight is attorney Joseph Tully. He's at least got some answers on this one, or at least will help us break it down. So, Joseph, one big thing here that's come out in the last day or two is that the defendant was wearing his seatbelt when he was crashing these vehicles into the other vehicle. So I'm wondering, how does that fit into the second part of that test?
Wearing the seatbelt. So on one hand, the prosecution will argue that because he was wearing his seatbelt, that meant that he knew, he could appreciate that he was driving a car, he was operating a vehicle, it was dangerous, and in order to have some kind of precautions, he put on his seatbelt. The defense will say, look, crazy people can put on seatbelts too. Look what he did while he was in the driver's seat wearing the seatbelt.
Yeah, two sides to the argument on that one, certainly. And I put you on the spot. You argued both sides of the case. It's like an old moot court exercise. But what about the burden of proof here? The defense really doesn't have to do a lot to convince the jury that he was legally insane.
Correct. The burden of proof is a preponderance of the evidence, which is one of the lowest legal standards that we have in court. And that is, again, imagine a scale, if you're a viewer, and one grain of sand in one. The side that has one grain of sand will win.
It doesn't take much. And, of course, the defense and the prosecution here really pushing this case towards a question of fact as to the insanity defense and not a lot about the emotion. I think that that's to their credit. But we're going to move along now, and we'll talk to you again in just a couple of seconds, Joseph, because the defense team for New England Patriots owner Robert Kraft is fighting back hard over accusations that the defense misled a judge. The accusations unfolded after a hearing over whether Florida authorities violated the Constitution when they recorded men receiving sexual massages inside a spa. The court documents allege that the defense threatened an officer who they say said would make up a reason to pull over a different suspect. Here is how that officer's actual in-court testimony unfolded.
The body cam also picks up audio, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And for whatever reason, I'm asking you, do you recall saying it doesn't matter in response to that? I can make some up.
You said this, that I said that during the Robert Kraft traffic?
No. Right, this traffic stop right before that. The traffic stop right before that when your audio was on, before you ever knew you were going to stop, Mr. Kraft.
Okay. I'm sorry. I don't remember saying that.
Okay.
And if I said it, I wouldn't even know the context of how it was said, and obviously in more of a joke with however you heard that.
Okay. So
that was said.
Okay. So whether it was a joke or not, you don't have
I don't have a recollection of it, so I'm not going to tell you that who I was talking to or whatever. I have zero recollection that I said that.
Right, but you're also not saying under oath, of course,
well, of
that
course
you're 100%
not, because
sure.
You probably have something where you're going to come back.
Wait a minute. The question was, do you recall? His answer is, no, he does not.
And then the final question is, while you may not specifically recall it, what you're not saying under oath is that there's no chance you said that, correct?
No, I wouldn't want to do that because you may come back. I don't remember saying anything like that. If I said something like that tongue in cheek or in a goofy manner, which obviously looks terrible now, respectfully, I don't remember saying that.
Okay, the state dug into the matter and filed this motion with the judge this week. A review of the radio transmissions and the body-worn camera video conclusively show that Officer Kimbark never made the inflammatory remark. Both attorneys Speary and Burke represented to the court that they had watched the body camera tape and heard this comment allegedly made during a previous stop. Either the assertion that they had reviewed the tape was untrue or the representation of what occurred during the tape was untrue. That is from the state's motion. Now, late yesterday, the defense tried to clear things up. Here's how the defense says the radio transmission really went. The officer you just saw said, "Anybody got anything better than pulling out of that plaza?" And then another officer said that the suspect was just driving like an angel. So Officer Kimbark said, "All right, I'll come up with something when I tell him. No swearing whatsoever. But is the substance equally damaging?" Attorney Joseph Tully back to discuss this case now. So Joseph, the Kraft defense is blaming another attorney for another suspect for telling the Kraft defense team the more crude version of this exchange was the accurate version. That's where they say they got it from. Turns out that it's not. They're admitting that now. So the defense is saying, look, we all knew what was supposedly said, it wasn't said in this crude way, and we wanted to cross-examine this guy on it because that's what we thought he said. Following me here? So
I am, yeah.
Yeah, the defense is saying, look, we were within our right to use the information we had at that time to cross-examine this guy on the stand, and the difference in the wording is inconsequential to whether this cop was willing to manufacture a probable cause for a stop. So are both sides at fault here or what?
Well, I mean, the conduct from the officer doesn't look good. I mean, he's saying that it was a joke. Maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. We would have to listen to it and, you know, sort of look at the content and the context and the tone. On the other hand, I think the defense attorneys for Mr. Kraft need to accept responsibility. What's wrong with taking accountability and saying, Judge, yes, the prosecution is correct in the sense of exactly what we told the court that he said. That wasn't accurate. However, the content And our point is exactly still the same. And that's what the court needs to pay attention to, not the exact verbiage, you know, what we thought he said versus what he really said, but what he said and when he said it and why he said it.
Yeah, okay. So, you know, the defense is also blaming the state for hiding the actual recording and the transcript for far too long. They're saying, wait a minute, the state can't go after us for contempt because the state didn't give us what we needed to ask the proper question the first time around. That's the other side of the defense here. So, look, the judge has got a lot to wade through in this case, not only with the suppression of the recording made inside the spa, but also with this. So, Joseph Tully, we'll be back to you again at the end of the broadcast here. Still ahead tonight on The Debrief. We're back inside the courtroom for the McStay family murders. Plus, or rather, I should say, the case has lasted months, and both sides are getting very, very testy. So, you'll get to hear some of the fights over evidence that the jury never heard after the break. Welcome back to The Debrief. Before we head back to court, let's check in with Chief Investigative Correspondent Brian Ross with a look at what he's working on tonight on Brian Ross Investigates. Brian, good evening.
Good evening, Aaron. Well, we've all heard about the sex abuse scandal at USA Gymnastics. Tonight, we're taking a look at the situation at USA Swimming, where it may be just as bad, if not worse, than USA Gymnastics. Hundreds of young teenage girls, swimmers, abused by their coaches, some 200 coaches permanently banned from the sport. And you'll see what happened when we tried to talk to the CEO and president of USA Swimming, Tim Henschy. He didn't want to talk to us at all.
Safe sport clubs exist today. Can you answer that question, sir? Mr. Henschy, really?
Failing to do enough to protect young swimmers. All that coming up tonight on Brian Ross Investigates, Aaron, right after your program.
Brian Ross trying to get answers for us. We will be watching. A setback in the case of the McStay family murders to report tonight. Defendant Charles Merritt is accused of killing business associate Joseph McStay and the entire McStay family in 2010. The graves of all four of the McStays turned up in the desert in 2013. Due to ongoing issues with the health of an attorney, the case is on hold until May 21st. Yesterday, the prosecution and the defense sparred over how much the jury can be told about another man, Dan Kavanaugh. The defense says Kavanaugh is the real killer, and guess what? Nobody can find him.
Without anything else, the defense gets up and says, it's Kavanaugh. And the DA wants to respond. If they thought it was Kavanaugh, they could have subpoenaed him, brought him in, questioned him about all of this. They didn't do it. I think they're entitled to say we attempted to locate him, to serve him, and we were unable to find him.
How is the court going to correct the fact that when they get up in their closing argument and he argues, yeah, he's gone because he killed him, and that's why we can't find him? Both sides are entitled to make that argument in closing argument, Your Honor, but it's not the proper subject for witness to come in and testify about.
But it's also, the court is presuming that that argument's going to be made as to Mr. Kavanaugh. The people's position, really, from the beginning is that Mr. Kavanaugh has little to no relevance to this case. The court has made him relevant by allowing in certain evidence as to him, but only in a very limited nature, based on his third-party culpability ruling. I think it's misplaced to assume that that argument's going to be made by the people.
Not to mention that this defense attorney questioned witnesses, his computer expert. Do you know if the prosecution has subpoenaed Daniel Kavanaugh? Do you know if the prosecution has subpoenaed Lauren Knowles?
Patently improper questions.
Actually, unethical, violates rules of professional conduct questions. But that's besides the point, Your Honor.
Both sides had a serious series of skirmishes over delays in the trial and other issues. Here's the fight over delays, including a serious swipe at defense claims that defense attorney James McGee has had to delay the case due to his own serious health issues.
These are starting to appear like intentional stall tactics, where you don't have experts completing work until the night before they testify, even though they've had the case for 3, 4, 5 years.
Can you imagine?
Then also,
can you imagine who's saying this, Your Honor? I mean, can you really imagine?
Every expert that the defense has called has provided their report the day of or the day before they testified.
That's Your Honor, our accountant provided it in July.
I'm not getting into, I don't care what was done before. Once again, every issue that comes up, you want to say, well, they did this and they did this and they did this, or we should get to do this.
Why are those comments directed at us? Why shouldn't those comments be directed at the prosecution, who hired an expert in the middle of trial?
We took almost the entire month of March off due to their scheduling of witness issues. Now we've taken what is mounting to going to be two and a half weeks off for Mr. McGee.
Well, 4 weeks.
Versus Mr. Moline's preparedness, which I sincerely question, considering I happened to be at a social event with Mr. McGee on Saturday where he was perfectly fine drinking and dancing. I'm starting to question that these unpreparedness with the video, getting a witness here, repeating fact after fact after fact that is cumulative to the people's entire case in chief, and the defense's cross-examination of it, is starting to appear like stall tactics, intentionally done. Not that it's a preparedness issue, because Mr. Moline on several occasions has shown himself to be competently prepared to handle a handoff witness such as Mr. Stutchman, to deal with last-minute issues that come up. And I think the court, at Mr. Dougherty's urging, needs to control these proceedings a little bit, because we're going to start losing jurors, and we will end up in a mistrial because of that.
Attorney Joseph Tully is here one last time on the debrief. Joseph, stall tactics. I mean, you know, the state's accusing the defense of stall tactics. Why is it that the defense is the one that's testing most of the DNA and uncovering a lot of that kind of evidence in this case? Who's stalling here?
Exactly, yeah. A lot of times the prosecution can put the defense attorney behind the eight ball and then complain when the defense attorney is coming up with last-minute things because the defense attorney received last-minute discovery.
And it's the defendant that has the right to a speedy trial. If he wants to waive that, then he can. I go back to that. It's a little bit different issue, but it's similar. Bottom line, though, Joseph, this is in your state. You're up in Northern California. This is Southern California. I don't know these litigators, so I can't say that they hate one another. But from my perspective here in New York, this is turning into a mean and nasty street fight.
It is, yeah, and this happened outside the jury, but it's actually pretty common. During the middle of trial, especially a long trial with a lot at stake, with media coverage, emotions run high. And it's almost like the old Warner Brothers cartoons with the sheepdog and the coyote. They, hey, Pete, hey, Tom, how you doing? They both punch in, and then during the course of the day, they beat the heck out of each other, and then at night, they punch out and shake hands and go home.
Well, you know, I mean, the word professionalism is supposed to be at play here, and they're complaining about what they saw, allegedly saw, at a social event. So maybe the lesson underneath there is that they are at least able to get along outside work. But of course, that got dragged back into the courtroom. So bottom line, we're going to wait for this one to roll out. Joseph Tully, appreciate your insight tonight.
Thank you for having me.
All right. And thanks for those of you watching The Debrief tonight. You can join us again tomorrow from 5 o'clock till 5:30 Eastern time with our live recap of the day's news in court. Have a good evening, and we will see you tomorrow.